Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Nasir Ghami, and welcome to my podcast. The episode today is on the 10 truths and 10 fallacies of psychopharmacology. And this is a sneak peek of some material that I have published in my textbook, Clinical Psychopharmacology, which I'm explaining here, but will also be part of a three-part series, a masterclass series, which I'll be providing on psychopharmacology that will be a deep dive into the first few chapters of my second edition revision of the psychopharmacology textbook that I wrote, which I'm doing right now. So as I'm revising the textbook, I want to share some of my material with you. And if you'd like to see some of that, please click the link on the website in the description to be on the waiting list, to be notified when that new masterclass series on my revised edition of the psychopharmacology textbook, first few chapters, is available. So this is a sneak peek of some of that material, and it's a summary topic that I have discussed that I call 10 truths and 10 fallacies of psychiatry. And I'm going to run through them with you. We're going to start with the fallacies. The first fallacy of 10 is that more is better. The idea that if a low dose helps you a little bit, you should just get a higher dose and that will help you more. Actually, some medications work better at lower doses than at higher doses. For instance, aripiprazole is more effective for bipolar depression at less than 10 milligrams a day than above 10 milligrams a day. Lamotrigine is as effective at 200 milligrams per day or less versus higher than 200 milligrams. There's no need to give higher doses. It doesn't work any better. Lithium often works in the 300 to 600 milligram day range for many patients with variations of bipolar illness. They do not need 900 milligrams a day or standard levels of 0.6 to 1.0. So it's just not true that more is better. The right dose is the right dose, and sometimes it's less rather than more. Second fallacy is what gets you well keeps you well. This is an unfortunate one. You can also call it the happily ever after fallacy. The idea that if you get better on a drug, just stay on it because it helped you now, it'll help you in the future. That's just not true. Many medications work symptomatically, acutely, short-term, but they do not have long-term disease-modifying prevention benefits, as we've discussed before. There are two kinds of medicines, symptomatic drugs like aspirin for a headache, Tylenol for pain, that help you with your current symptoms. And then there's disease-modifying drugs like statins or antihypertensives or chemotherapies, which prevent future disease progression or episodes or worsening. A lot of times, the disease-modifying drugs like statins, antihypertensive drugs, have no symptom benefits at all. You take them, you don't notice anything, but you still take them because they're preventing future problems. Symptom drugs may help your symptoms. Your Tylenol makes your pain go better. Your aspirin gets your fever better, but it doesn't treat the underlying disease. And keeping on aspirin for fever is not going to help you if you don't treat the underlying infection. As I've said before, the majority of antidepressants and psychiatric drugs are symptomatic and not disease-modifying. So this what gets you well keeps you well assumption with those drugs is both false and harmful. Third fallacy, treat to remission. If a drug helps a little bit, take two. If that doesn't help enough, take three. Well, as many of you may know, when this is looked at in randomized clinical trials, there's very little evidence actually of added benefit from multiple drugs in many settings. For instance, in the STAR-D study of depression, once you failed two or three antidepressants, no matter what you added or changed to, you had an 85% likelihood of not responding at all, only a 15% likelihood of responding once you failed two or three antidepressants. So you can keep adding and adding and adding, but it's not going to make any difference in the vast majority of patients, 85%. However, much more of them will get side effects. So adding many medications will give you more side effects, but it doesn't really help you get less symptoms often. So this concept that we need to get remission, that we need to get rid of all symptoms, is an assumption, and we don't even achieve this goal, even if it's legitimate. And I would argue that the assumption is false in many ways too. The fourth fallacy, the polypharmacy is good. This is a variant on the previous fallacy. You know, if the drug works, we'll take two. That should be even better. That's just not true. Sometimes it is the case. Sometimes it's proven. And that's fine. But where it's not proven, it's often not true. And we should not assume it. Fifth fallacy, make one change at a time. A lot of times people say this, how do I know if this will help me? If you make two changes, which one helped me? Well, it doesn't really matter as long as you get better. We're not doing research here. This is clinical practice. It's very interesting to me that many people who've never done any research act like they pretend to be a researcher when they're treating patients in clinical practice, which is the opposite of research. You're not trying to prove anything. You're just trying to get the patient better. If you make two or three changes at a time, if you need to really want to find out and say you add two drugs and they don't want to be on both, well, later you can stop one of them and then you'll see if that was the one that helped or not. The reason not to emphasize on making one change at a time all the time is that there is such a thing as going too slowly in your treatment. And especially in the beginning of treatment, say someone's the new patient and they're on multiple drugs that are harmful for them, it's important to make multiple changes initially to try to get the patient better more quickly. Another fallacy, 4 to 8 weeks is a sufficient trial of a drug. Well, this is sometimes true for acute treatment studies, but not for maintenance studies. You know, you need to be on lamotrigine for 6 months to a year or longer to know if you're preventing a new episode. It doesn't do anything in 8 weeks, has no symptom benefits at all. So it depends on whether you're doing acute symptom treatment or long-term disease modifying preventive treatment to say how long you need to be on the drug. It's not always just 4 to 8 weeks. Another fallacy, dose low, go slow. Well, this is common and I'm not opposed to it. However, sometimes you need to go a little faster and patients are suffering a lot and you shouldn't always dose low and go slow. Don't start valproate at 250 milligrams all the time. Sometimes you can start at 500 and go quickly to 750. You don't always have to go slow. And the final ones, always taper a drug. Well, okay, if a drug has a discontinuation syndrome, taper it. But if it doesn't have a discontinuation syndrome, you don't need to taper it, especially if it's a relatively new drug and the patient is not taken for a long time. You can get off pretty quickly. You start valproate and 2 months later decide to stop it, just stop it. There's no withdrawal syndrome with valproate. On the other hand, there is with lithium, and you might taper it a little. But again, if it's only 2 months, they're not going to have the effects long enough being on it to have a withdrawal effect. But if you're on an SRI for 3, 4, 5 years, of course you need to taper that slowly. But it depends on the drug. If there's a withdrawal syndrome, taper it. If there's not, don't taper it. You don't have to. Another fallacy that's terrible is the one that says treat the most severe symptom. This is really terrible in the practice of psychiatry. Imagine if you had a serious infectious disease and the focus was, well, let's treat the most severe symptom, which is your fever. And you get nothing but Tylenol for the fever and no one's trying to figure out what the infection is and how to treat that with the right antibiotic. Same thing in psychiatry. Oftentimes the symptom that bothers the patient the most is very irrelevant to the diagnosis and the treatment. Oh, I can't concentrate. That's so terrible. My concentration is horrible. And everyone will say, oh, I'll give you an amphetamine for your so-called ADD, when in fact you're manic or you're depressed and you have a manic depressive disease and no one's bothering to treat that. So forget the severe symptom. Treat the underlying disease. Always incorporate the patient's preference. Well, that's good, but sometimes the patient's preference is wrong. And if oftentimes patients, especially if they've seen a lot of psychiatrists, been on a lot of different medications, sometimes they will have believed that they have enough knowledge to really push wanting something or another. We often see this with ADD drugs, amphetamines, and stimulants, unfortunately. And they really want it. Well, okay, you can want it, but I don't have to give it to you. The patient's preference isn't right if the patient doesn't understand what their diagnosis is correctly and understand the reason for the right treatment. In most people, a logical discussion can be had where that kind of agreement can be achieved. But in a minority of people, often who have already made up their minds, maybe they have secondary gain, you can't convince them, you can't persuade them. And in that case, the patient's preference is not the final say. So those are the 10 fallacies of psychiatry, of psychopharmacology. I'm going to shift to the 10 truths of psychopharmacology. So here's the good news or how we might treat patients better. First truth is that your treatment is as good as your diagnosis. This is an old saying from Ned Kasem, one of my old teachers. So your treatment is as good as your diagnosis. In other words, if your diagnosis is wrong, it doesn't matter how good the drug is or how many drugs you use, it's not going to work. Bottom line is, we have to make sure our diagnoses are right for our drugs to work. And it's a deeper problem than simply being wrong about a diagnosis. The problem in a deeper sense is that the whole DSM system is wrong about its diagnoses for the majority of diagnoses that are scientifically invalid or false, as we've discussed previously. And since we're using false scientifically invalid diagnoses, it doesn't matter how good our treatments are seeming in clinical trials, they're not going to work so well in clinical practice. And in fact, they don't work so well in clinical trials, partly because our diagnoses are not valid. So try to use valid diagnostic constructs, usually non-DSM ones, as we teach it on this podcast, and then your treatments can be much more effective. Second truth of psychopharmacology, treat diseases, not symptoms. Don't treat the fever, treat the underlying infection. Don't treat the pain, treat the underlying disease. Of course, you can treat the fever and you can treat the pain so the patient feels better, but that should not be the main focus of treatment. That should not be what you do 100% for 50 years. It's something you put a little attention to for a few weeks or a few months, and then you stop that symptom treatment while you're treating the underlying disease. So if the patient has depressive symptoms, it's not enough to say, okay, take an SRI and we're done, and take it for years. You might give an SRI for a few months for that depressive symptoms currently, but find out why the patient has those depressive symptoms. What is that depressive episode? Is it a bipolar depressive episode, in which case you shouldn't give SRI at all, give them a mood stabilizer? Is it a melancholic depression, which won't respond to SRIs either and may need ECT or other treatments? Is it vascular depression, which doesn't respond to antidepressants at all and may need more attention to hypertension treatment? Treat the underlying diseases, not the symptoms. Third truth of psychopharmacology, all drugs are guilty until proven innocent. This is an old saying from the 19th century from Oliver Wendell Holmes, a physician, that you should not prescribe medications on the mentality that they're safe until you find out that they're not safe, that they have problems. Rather, you should prescribe on the mentality that they're all unsafe, and you would only prescribe if there's benefits that are proven well enough to outweigh their harms. All drugs are harmful. All drugs have side effects. It's important to realize that and then say, okay, I won't prescribe unless I have clear evidence of benefit. The reason this is important is that people will, for instance, often give drugs that they think are safe or benign, like gabapentin or buspirone, things that don't have a lot of side effects, and they give it uselessly to patients who just don't get any better with it because they're not effective for much often, or they're used in settings where they're not effective, like mood illnesses. And the problem there is that the clinician is being too conservative and too focused on their own safety, the clinician's safety, the patient not having harms and side effects, so they're not going to be upset with the clinician, as opposed to trying to improve the patient's symptoms. Instead, using drugs like lithium, for instance, which might have more side effects, but is much more effective for whatever the patient might have. Now, this truth of psychopharmacology links to the next one, that all drugs are toxic. It's only the dosing and indication that makes them therapeutic. All drugs are toxic. It's only the dosing and duration and indication that makes them therapeutic. This is another old saying. It goes back to the medieval era from Paracelsus, the founder of modern chemistry. And Hoop again pointed out that there's no drug that would have biological benefit unless it also has biological harm. So we should never pretend that a drug is safe, quote unquote. All drugs are harmful. The only question is if the safety is tolerable, it's small enough that it's outweighed by the benefits of the drug. And the benefit is in treating the underlying disease. That's the indication concept. And it's also in getting the dosing right. You want to get the dose right so you're getting the benefit and you're not unnecessarily causing more harm with a higher dose. For instance. And now we have, I think, our fifth truth of psychopharmacology, always have an exit strategy. This is a concept that I took from military tactics. You don't start a war, ideally, unless you have an idea how to end it. And don't start treatment unless you have a sense of when it's going to stop. don't just prescribe and then say, okay, take this forever. No. The day you prescribe, you tell the patient, we're going to do this for 2 months or 3 months or 6 months or a year if you get better, and then we're going to discuss coming off of it. Unless you actually do have a rationale for long-term treatment and then you give it. But you don't just prescribe and not discuss how long you want to prescribe and why you would go long-term versus short-term. Again, the distinction between symptomatic and disease-modifying effect is relevant, which brings us again to our next truth of psychopharmacology, that most of our current psychiatric medications are symptomatic in their benefits. They are not disease-modifying. The clearest exception is lithium, which is a disease-modifying drug. It improves the long-term course of bipolar illness. The hallmark of disease modification is improving the long-term course of the disease, not the current symptoms. It shows the drug is disease modifying. If you take it for a year or 5 years or 10 years, the disease goes away. Well, the disease is not active at all. It's in remission. It's not something you would know in a month or 2 months, like most of our studies. Most of our studies show that the drugs that we use help patients for their symptoms for a month or two. That's the case with antidepressants for depression, anxiolytics for anxiety, amphetamines and stimulants for attention, antipsychotics for psychotic symptoms in schizophrenia. That's 95% of the research that's randomized that we have. Very few drugs have been studied for a year or longer and shown that they improve the course of the illness. And again, that's limited to lithium and some of the mood stabilizers in manic depressive illness. So make this distinction. Know when your drug is symptomatic and know when the drug is disease modifying. And in the case of the former, use them short term for symptoms, but not long term in general, with some exceptions like antipsychotics and schizophrenia, which suppress symptoms enough that maybe the benefits outweigh the harms. But outside of that, often the benefits don't outweigh the harms in other illnesses. And in the latter case, disease modifying drugs, you do use them long term. That's what they're for. And then the last truths of psychopharmacology, older drugs are more effective than newer drugs, which links to the next truth. Newer drugs are more tolerable than older drugs. It's not true that our new medications are better than our older medication in a general sense. They may be better in terms of side effects. They are. SRIs have less side effects than tricyclic antidepressants. That's obvious. But they are not more effective. SRIs have been repeatedly proven less effective than tricyclic antidepressants, as well as monoamine oxidase inhibitors, are older antidepressants, which of course had more side effects and risks, but were also more effective. The new mood stabilizers like lamotrigine are not more effective than older drugs like lithium. That's been proven too. New antipsychotics are not more effective than older antipsychotics, including clozapine, which is very old, from the 1970s and known to be the most effective one. So it's interesting that our most effective drugs are the old ones. So if you have patients who are not getting better, try using some of these older medications because they do work. And the reason we use the new ones is just because they're more tolerable, which is great. But don't be fooled into thinking that's because they're also more effective, which they're not. And then the ninth truth of psychopharmacology, treatment, quote unquote, resistance usually reflects either misdiagnosis or an invalid diagnosis. And we talked about this in a prior podcast on treatment resistant depression, where I said there is no such thing as treatment resistant depression. It's just a false, invalid, major depressive disorder, DSM definition, which, because it's false and invalid, does not respond well to any specific drug intervention of some specific mechanism like serotonin effects. The antidepressants don't work well, not because they're not effective enough. It's because the diagnosis is not specific enough for those drugs to work. That's the invalid diagnosis concept. The other thing that happens is the patients just get misdiagnosed. So they have bipolar type 2 depression. You routinely misdiagnose as so-called major depressive disorder. Antidepressants don't work in bipolar depression. Therefore, the patient's labeled treatment resistant, whereas in fact, they're just misdiagnosed bipolar illness and they respond fine to mood stabilizers. And the last truth of psychopharmacology, the course, not symptoms, reveals the diagnosis. It's the long-term course of the illness that tells you what the illness is, not your current symptoms. Don't keep focusing on the current symptoms, diagnosing the current symptoms, treating the current symptoms. That's what most people do in psychiatry and psychopharmacology today. It's understandable because that's what the DSM system is set up on, and that's also what most of the clinical trial research does. It looks at current symptoms. But that's not the way to make people better in the long run. So, you know, we keep saying, oh, the patient's depressed. The patient's anxious. The patient can't concentrate. Let me give them something for each of those symptoms. And we forget, we don't pay any attention to the fact that this patient has had recurrent depressive and hypomanic episodes, say, and they have bipolar 2 illness, and therefore they need lithium or some mood stabilizer for long-term disease modification prevention benefits. We need to look at the long-term to know what the diagnosis is. That also then allows us to then decide which medications to give them for long-term disease modification versus not. So don't focus on just symptoms. Pay attention to the long-term course of the illness. That's also important and would change the way we practice as well. So this is my list of 10 truths and fallacies of psychopharmacology. And I encourage you again to consider following up on the link below in the podcast in the description if you want to be on the wait list for our upcoming sneak peek masterclass course, where I do a further deep dive into the first few chapters of my revision of my psychopharmacology textbook and let you see the changes that I'm making, the thoughts that I have now that are new, and share those with you. So I hope you sign up for that, and I hope to see you again at the next podcast episode for my podcast. Thanks a lot. I'll see you next time.